In Atlanta, but before the Georgia sun sets, we've got one last audition to show you.
Hello, my name is Larry Platt.
My name is General Larry Platt, yes.
The General?
General Larry Platt.
Oh, you're a general, okay.
I want to sing my song called Pants on the Ground.
Hats on the ground.
Pants on the ground.
Okay, what's it about?
Need putting our pants up.
All right.
Okay.
Can
ready
I sing?
You are.
Okay, ready?
1, 2, 3.
Pants on the ground, pants on the ground, looking like a fool with your pants on the ground, with the gold in your mouth, hat turned sideways, pants hit the ground, call yourself a cool cat, looking like a fool, running downtown with your pants on the ground, get here, hey, get your pants on the ground, looking like a fool, running, talking with your pants on the ground, get here,
yeah.
Hey, get your pants on the ground, looking like a fool with your pants on the ground, gold in your mouth,
okay.
Hat turned sideways.
Thank you.
Yeah, looking like a fool. Talking with your pants on the ground.
Larry. Thank you. Larry, what was that song called?
Pants on the ground.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Positive?
Thank you.
You know, I have a horrible feeling that song could be a hit.
Yeah. I'm gonna get my pants up. I'm gonna buy some belts after this.
What you just heard was an outtake of American Idol, courtesy of YouTube. The video featuring the General Larry Platt performing his original song, Pants on the Ground, has become a viral sensation, spawning various tribute covers, remixes, and parodies. According to a recent CBS News interview with Platt, who didn't just sing, but actually burst into a couple of impromptu splits during the idol performance of his song, the tune was inspired by a leisurely walk down the street in which he saw a guy with a baby bottle in his mouth and his pants on the ground. Needless to say, I understand Platt's frustration. There have been many of occasions where I have wanted to tell a young sagger to pull his pants up myself. However, when I first saw the clip, I couldn't help but to agree with Simon Cowell. I too knew that Platt would become this year's William Chung. What I found most odd was during his audition for Idol, no reference was made to the 68-year-old owned history. No one asked him why he was called the General, a name which I would later find out was given to him by prominent civil rights leader who was impressed by Platt's efforts in the 1960s when he was a teenage crusader for the civil rights movement in Georgia. None of the Idol judges inquired about the Troy Davis button adorning his chest, which undoubtedly was a homage to a condemned prisoner who maintains his innocence in the 1989 killing of a cop. Nor did Ryan Seacrest narrate a montage highlighting Platt's current work as a community activist, working with the United Youth Adult Conference, a volunteer organization set up to find missing children in the Atlanta area, as well as fighting against housing foreclosure. As catchy of a message for public decency the song was meant to be, the problem, as I see it, is that Platt was not treated with the dignity his age and life story deserved on the show. Instead, he was told he was too old to be an American Idol, a fact that the producers probably knew prior to him going before the cameras. and then shown the door. The rest would just become viral history. Now, folks may think that I'm reading too much into this, but as a student of popular culture, I find myself becoming more vigilant of the representations of African Americans in the media. As a black journalist, I understand how the images we absorb, whether it be on billboards, television, magazines, and the big screen, can create a lasting impression, both good and bad. And depending on who and how our stories are told, not only affects how other people see us, but how we see ourselves. Last month, I attended the October Gallery Fest Art Fair, which was held at North by Northwest in Mount Airy. There I met Angela Murphy, African-American author of Crossover to Healing, a poetry book which revisits the pain of childhood sexual abuse. In this next clip, you'll hear an interview I did with Murphy, who published the book as well as a great audiobook herself. She shares with me how not only writing about her abuse has empowered her, but how the way in which she shares her story has helped to set free other women who have gone through the same journey. So we're here with Angela Murphy, and she's the author of Crossover to Healing.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Crossover to Healing is like my testimony in poetry form. It's broken up into four chapters: the pain, the journey, the healing and living. The pain is how I grew up in an abusive home. My mom was on drugs when I was younger, and I had three older brothers, and they were put into foster care because she was neglecting us, and they were abused in foster care. And when we were returned back to my mom, they started sexually abusing me. And I had low self-esteem and depression growing up, and I journeyed into relationships with people who were abusive and using me. And then I reverted inwardly, cut myself off from the outside world because I was having some mental health issues. And the healing so I became with God's help and counseling, which is how the book was born, through counseling. He told me to write down how I was feeling. It was like a purging process, writing. And now I'm a foster parent and adoptive parent, and going around speaking to different women's groups or wherever I can, share my story, trying to reverse the cycle. What is your destiny? It has been predetermined that you be daughter, son, sister, brother. It's up to you to develop those relationships. It has been decreed beforehand that you be mother, father. How you bond with and enhance the lives of your children is up to you. It was settled in the mind of the Father that you be friend. It's up divine guidance that we travel life's road. It's up to you to enrich the lives around you. Have you fulfilled your destiny? Have you detoured from your scheduled path? Have the obstacles set before you to purposely prevent you from pursuing your destiny been successful? When the wicked one intercedes and tries to discourage you from your course, you must fight, stay focused, and chase your destiny.
Right, because you said it was like therapy for you, so I can imagine it took. It wasn't just something that you just wrote in a month. Or...
Well, the first two chapters were the purging process, the pain and the journey, and the healing came like about 2 years later. So I went to counseling again with my pastor, and that's how the healing came about.
Okay. And what inspired you to share it? Because with so much pain, I guess for some people it's hard. They want to stuff it down.
Yeah,
but you chose.
And because I did for years, I wasn't healing. And, you know, I had the other effects like relationship issues. Like I said, journey into relationships with people who are abusive. That was part of the Band-Aid that I had covering the pain. And I have other friends who've had similar problems in their past, and they've been dealing with drug problems, alcohol problems, and, you know, it's just like sharing and letting them know that you don't have to stay in that rut. And often people who are abused take on guilt like it was something that they did and something, you know, they caused it. And, you know, it's not your fault. Not, you know, that's why I want to let everybody know it's not their fault. It's something that was done to you, not that you asked for it.
And besides the book, you also have CDs.
Yes.
And it's you reading the poem?
Yes, it's an audiobook, and in between each chapter, there's like a song that's almost like an introduction to each chapter.
Songs that are meaningful to you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, so how can people get in contact with you?
I have a website, www.crossovertohealing.com, and I'm also on Facebook and MySpace, and you can reach me by cell phone, 267-230-7983.
Okay, thank you so much, Angela.
Thank you.
Pain is not exclusive to Black people. However, listening to Murphy reminds me of how important it is for Black people who undergo some sort of trauma see and relate to people of the same hue, who too have gone and survived. But what happens when this story is just plain fiction? One of the biggest movies last year was Lee Daniels' film Precious. The movie itself, which is based off the book Push by Sapphire, has received critical acclaim for its gritty portrayal of abuse and dysfunction of a 350-pound pregnant teenager from Harlem. There has even been talk of possible Oscar nomination for the movie's two biggest stars, no pun intended, of course. But as the enthusiasm for this movie continues to grow, there has also been a lot of division within the African American community about the appropriateness of the images and themes within the film, particularly whether or not Black folks needed another film that portrayed us in a not so positive light. Last year, I attended the Philadelphia premiere of the film Precious, along with half of Black Philadelphia. I left with a mixed feeling. And although some time has passed, I'm still on the fence. Good film. However, Precious, in my opinion, follows a laundry list of Black-themed films which presents Black folks in very desperate situations. Not unusual for Hollywood. However, since the movie starred an all-Black cast, was directed by a Black director, produced by Oprah and Tyler Perry, and based on a book by a Black woman, maybe I'm being a little too sensitive. And just like Murphy, maybe this film could be the inspiration needed for all the little precious in our community. I won't say anymore, I'll just let you be the judge. Listen as Lee Daniels, who was also present for the Philadelphia premiere, explains why he felt that Precious was a story that needed to be told.
When I was 11 years old, there was a girl that I played with a row houses down for me, and she, it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and she came to my door, my friend, 5 years old, naked, bleeding, pus dripping from her skin, sweat, crying, and she said, my mommy's going to kill me, and I remember looking over my shoulder. And my mother was in fear. And I, you know, my mother's a Philly girl. It takes a lot to make her afraid. And she, I remember feeling like nauseous, fearful, angry, embarrassed for the girl. I can't define in one word how I felt. And when I read the book some 30-some-odd years later, it evoked those same feelings for me, and I wanted to heal. I wanted to heal myself. And I felt that if I, since I'm not a plumber, I only know how to make movies, that I felt that other people would heal through my cinema and me telling the story.
You know, so many of your characters through Monsters Ball, The Woodsman, Shadow Box, and Tennessee, are characters who really have to fight for themselves. That's a link through many of your films. Why do you think that is?
I think that I'm a fighter. I think that, I left Philadelphia to go to Hollywood with a dream and $7 in my pocket. And I'm a fighter. And I think that, the streets of Philadelphia live in me and live in my work. And I think that Philadelphians have we're tough. I think that, and I speak for the people. I don't like to see movies. I see enough movies that have the perfect ending. You know, I can go to the studios to see that. I like to see stuff that make people think, and
Did you know growing up that you could be a director in Hollywood? I mean, did you dream like that?
Yes, my mother taught me to dream. I have a godfather here who also taught me to dream. He was in dance class, took me to dance class and stuff like that. I was encouraged to dream.
And were they your champions?
Yes.
Yeah. When you wanted to then take this dream and get it financed, did you have to, what was it like to convince people that this could be a motion picture?
I believe that this film has been blessed with angels, you know. This was the easiest film ever to get financed. I knew not to go to the studios with it. I knew I'd learned from Monsters Ball that they thought I was crazy about a fat boy dying and a white man and a white black girl. It was impossible to get that financed in the studio. Same thing with Woodsman, which we shot here in Philadelphia. I knew that no one was going to finance. I couldn't go to a studio and say, you want to do a movie about a 355-pound black girl. That was just not, so I had grown and my reputation had grown in such a way that that these people just said, what do you want to do, Lee? And I said, I want to do this movie, and they gave it to me, so they were my angels. And then that Sapphire, whose work is unbelievable, if you've not read the book, it's of course mind-boggling that she gave it to me. She didn't have to give me this book. She didn't want anyone to have this book. She thought that she's a true auteur and a scholar in the biggest of ways. She thought that if someone made this into a movie, it could fuck up her book. And she trusted me with it. And I'm just honored that she. So that was one other angel. And the other angel was that we didn't go to DVD. Like, I thought we were going to go to DVD, we were going to go to DVD, and we didn't. I got accepted to Sundance, and I won. And then as I'm winning, Oprah Winfrey's calling me. She's like, I'm walking into the, accepting my award, and my phone rings, and it's unknown. And I'm walking up the stage to get my award, and she says, it's Oprah. And I go, huh? She said, it's Oprah Winfrey. And I go, hi, I can't talk because I'm getting my award right now on Sundays. She said, well, why are you picking up the phone? She said, but you know, the only person that would pick up a phone is an independent film. Unknown means you got money or your face. So why pick up the phone? And so she called me back, and she is another angel that just said that anything that she could do to support the film, and that has been really a godsend.
Well, later she comes in as an executive producer. How does that impact your being able to take the film out to the public?
I think Philadelphians understand that. I made the movie, as I told you earlier. I think that we understand the film because we see her on the streets every day. But I don't know that Mid-America would necessarily embrace Precious. I think you're a different audience than Oklahoma City, for example. And I think that what Oprah does is she speaks to that audience in a way that, I can't.
Before I take this out to you folks, and I'm going to get there in just a second, there was one sequence, I was watching the film again this time, and I saw it in Sundance with that first audience, and I got to tell you, that was one hell of a screening. But this time what caught my eye is a sequence that sort of eluded me the first time. And it's the sequence where Precious is watching TV and Sophia Loren is on television. And it was a really sort of fleeting moment, but it was very, very dense. Because one, there's through her eyes, there's this sort of pain of white beauty. And then, on the other hand, there's something about that sequence that entrances her and talks about, I felt that you felt that cinema has incredible power, and you referred to it almost a moment ago, or you did a moment ago. And I'm wondering what you feel, in fact, is the power that cinema has, and the power that your cinema, what power you hope that your cinema has.
I don't look at my movies the way you all do. I look at them as a growth, how I grow as a man. What have I learned? What I learned in the beginning, who I was, and then how I end up. What's on the screen, I love, because all of my movies are like my kids. Some of them may have a little nub or a finger, but for the most part, I love them all. So I don't look at the end result. I look at the journey that I took. And what I learned about myself was that I am a racist, that I see Precious every day, and I don't see her. I thought that if you were overweight, and that if you were darker than me, you were slovenly, you were lazy, you were smelly, you were stupid. And I learned a lot about myself, and I hope that other people will take that away too.
Now, I can't do Oprah, but I can do Phil Donahue. So who of you wants to talk into my microphone here and ask us a question? Who we got that wants to know something or wants to say something? I need a show of hands. Here I come. I'm coming to you. We got one, a live one here.
Hi, good evening. I just wanted to ask Gabby, was that her first experiencing acting? And well, since she's not here, I'm not sure if he'll be able to answer. But is there any other projects that she intends to do?
Yes, that was her first job. 400 Girls Later, I got tired. I mean, literally 400 Girls Later, I interviewed, and I stopped counting. And Gabby auditioned for our genius casting director, Billy Hopkins, and so she came. I saw the tape. She came in, and when she came in, she started talking like that white girl that you hear. You know, she's gonna talk like, you know, she's Precious. And I went, whoa. The girls that I had auditioned were girls that were Precious. And I hired her because if I had hired any of those other girls, I would have been exploiting them. I would have not, they wouldn't have been acting. And I didn't want to exploit them. And I think she was, and she does have another job. She just got a job. Gabby has a job where she plays a bad girl. And she's beating up, she plays like a bad girl in high school, and she's beating up, she plays Mary. I'm excited. Not Mary, you know, bad girl.
We're here.
You might remember the hoopla over the Publishers Weekly cover for its annual AfroPicks, which highlights new books and trends in African American publishing. The cover featured a black woman with fisted hair picks reminiscent of the Black Power movement growing out of her head, which basically is a not so tongue-in-cheek reference to the annual spread. Those who were upset thought that the cover was either too aggressive or just plain exploitative. But what many people who were initially upset about the cover didn't realize was that the photograph was taken by Lauren Kelly and was featured in a collection of African American themed photography book called Posing Beauty, African American Images from the 1890s to the Present, edited by Deborah Willis, chair of the New York University's Photography Department and winner of the MacArthur's Genius Award. Willis, an African American, has authored several books about how black beauty has been historically defined, exploited, manipulated, and marketed. Willis was recently at the Central Branch of the Philadelphia Free Library presenting some of the photos from her book. The imagery of black folks of different genders and generations were amazing and made me think about today's mass media, which only shows limited views of black folks, which are rarely reflected in our community.
The notion that I experienced growing up in Philadelphia and then also looking at photographs and studying here, as I mentioned earlier, that I also attended the library often as a young person, my sister and I often spending a lot of time in a public library. So this talk is about my research of visiting the library and then also looking at images. This also is a story that started in the 1890s that I was interested in talking about, but one of the most important images that I identified was in 1863. I thought it was really an important moment to include this in this story, that as I think about the notion of beauty, this is a runaway slave ad, and it says, "Ran away from the yard corner of Jackson and Broad Streets, Augusta, Georgia, on the morning, Tuesday, 7 April, 1863, a woman, Dolly, whose likeness is here seen. She's 30 years of age, light complexion, hesitates somewhat when spoken to, and is not a very healthy woman, but rather good looking with a fine set of teeth." So imagine, this is, as I read this, I thought about this experience of this owner, never changed her owner, and has been a house servant always. It is thought that she had been enticed off by some white man, being herself a stranger to the city and belonging to a Charleston family. For further notice, please apply to this police station in Augusta, Georgia, or a lawyer, Antoine Poulain in Augusta, Georgia. But this is Louis Manicault, owner of Dolly. Owner of Dolly actually feels betrayed that Dolly has left him, possibly for another white man, that Dolly was the person who was possibly his concubine. But he had Dolly photographed often. We can see that she was in a photographer's studio. We can see that it was in a significant studio because we can see the back of the chair. That he cut her photograph in half to pasted on this piece of paper that circulated in Charleston and Augusta, Georgia, Columbia, South Carolina, and it circulated through the South. And the most important aspect of this, it happened after emancipation. So that this is a man who desired Dolly and searched for her during this time period. And as I began the research, I was interested in looking for a new kind of an archive that has been basically erased from our public memory, and an archive that actually tells multiple stories. And this is one story about a woman who was a mail order bride, and there were a number of black miners in the West and in San Francisco as well as Montana that traveled right after slavery, where black men were developing their lives with the westward migration, considering a life outside of slavery. That they often sent letters and published letters in church newspapers, as well as in the black press, black newspapers. So just imagine that women flocked to photography studios to tell their stories, to create their biography as they looked and searched for a new life outside of teaching or outside of cleaning homes, but looking at life as new at the westward movement. So here is a young woman posed for the studio, and just imagine a young miner receiving her photograph. Here are two sisters, and another one of my favorite images that a student at Talladega College. Here She is posed, confident, she is fashionably dressed, and we see that she's sending a message directly to the viewer that she's beautiful, she's confident, she's educated. On the back, it actually describes what she's studying at the time. So we begin to see images that were made in the 1890s, within 30 years at the end of slavery, images seen in modern woman of turn of the century. Another type of image that was sent, part of that notion of mail order brides, women going to the studio, a Texas woman. That also in, this is in 1923, this is a Mardi Gras queen in Oakland, California. And here we see the winner. We began to see how studio photographers were used to document activities in communities, Easter Sunday as a way of documenting the notion of rebirth, how Easter Sunday is viewed at a time when, this is Russell Lee's photograph, a time when black communities were going through a transformation. This is in New York, so we see a family on Sunday. We also see that club women were central to identifying their notion of beauty and community. That we can see the painted backdrop with the staircase, to images that were advertising images. That at this time, a number of companies, hairdressing and facial, I guess, companies in terms of creating ways to improve skin, because of many women, a number of women worked in the fields, and the dry heat, the dust changed their skin and hair. So we can also see that just the imagination of the Nile Queen, just in terms of language and identity, transformed some of the people who were buying products to connect with Africa. We also know that Madame C.J. Walker was popular in 1906. That here she is posed with an ad advertising her new wares, and she was once a washerwoman, and the description of this, the photographer, the writer says that she's hiding her hands from the photographer, but she's showing her hair that she was able to grow as a result of the pomades that she created. She was concerned about women working in the fields, that women had to tie their hair and wear their hair in a certain way, that because women were losing their hair as a result of work and field work that they were experiencing. And that she was proof that she was the modern woman dressed with a fancy lace dress as well, and the bodice, full bodice. And we see also that her hairstyle. So women were beginning to beauty begetting beauty, beauty emulating beauty. And also, this is an image, I want to go back to the other image, but I wanted to start with this image, National Types of Beauty, a series of 36 actual photographs. This is China. This is Miss Anna Mae Wong, an actress, popular in the 20s. One of my former students sent me a set of these, 36, and was curious about the fact that there were no black African or African-American women in this notion of national types of beauty from around the world. He was curious about my interest in beauty and thought that it's a possibility that I wanted to do something about this. It was really nice for me to see that students are listening to my work and want to support in some way. So I thought about this and read about how men would often purchase photographs, these actual photographs, and then here you can see here 50 real photographs as they smoked. They were placed in tobacco cards and tobacco packages, but also with cigarettes as well as tobacco, that men could equate looking at beauty and smoking as, in terms of it as desire. So we can see this as a sense of equating desire. As we look at women, beautiful women, we can see that this pack has Josephine Baker, and here is another cinema star and from around the world. Also, images that Ida B. Wells, the photograph of Ida B. Wells, that I found really fascinating because she wrote to the black press saying that she was concerned indicating that she was concerned about the images of women and how they were perceived and accepted and degraded in the black press. And she felt that they needed to change. And black press in Indianapolis newspaper said that Ada B. Wells is mistaken to think that she needs to equate beauty and intelligence. And so she challenged this notion that beauty and intelligence had to be looked at in a serious way. And she began to write about the experiences of a woman who also fought against killing and brutality of communities, but also looked at the importance of beauty in her discussion. That also women who won awards, such as this photograph here is in Silhouette magazine, a rare magazine. If you ever have a chance to see it, please save it or send it to your local library for preservation. But we see Hattie McDaniels in her white fur coat, in her white, standing in front of her white baby grand, a woman who played, quote, Mammy, as you see on the cover, for Gone with the Wind. But we see that she also understands the notion of how to retell her story and her beauty through style and fashion. Then, and also in 1913, W.B. Du Bois created the Crisis magazine as the editor. He also created a beauty contest titled The Star of Ethiopia. And he invited people to send their photographs, and a number of people judged the quality of the photograph, the aspirations of the young sitters, and the queens, and then often published the winner on the cover. This is also a significant image. This is a photograph that's entitled Desert Queen. And we see this Edward Curtis, who's known as a photographer who photographed Native Americans. This is photographed in 1900 in Seattle, Washington. Here we see a young woman who is desirous in terms of beauty, but also identified as a queen. Desert, mainly taking her outside of the city of Seattle, but connecting her with a notion of Africa. Also that I thought it was really important to see fashion. This is a Frances Benjamin Johnston photograph. It's a deteriorated negative, but I thought that the image said so much about women in terms of a period, 1906, and they're attending the World's Fair. They're fashionable, they're wearing, they have their parasol, and also their fancy hats. And so we see women on their way, hanging out for a day, to women also who had desire to be dancers and singers and performers. We see this young woman who is posed in front of a mirror, reflecting her beauty, looking and admiring, but also she has a powder brush, and so she is placing powder on her back. It's a very seductive way that she holds the wrap around her body. And then we can see the notion of fashion, the experience of fashion as we see her hairstyle. And this is the same time that King Tut's tomb was open, and we also begin to see how it was important for artists and photographers and writers to document the experience and what they saw and what they experienced with the opening of the tomb. Some were hairstyles, and so they created hairstyles such as the Tut cut that was a part of a beginning of the style that we can see how beauty is seen through this experience of King Tut's tomb. There were women who were chorus line dancers. Then also I began to see images of men, and I found it really important to find images that talked about dandyism, that experienced fashion with men. I wanted to also include images of everyday images, images of girls out playing, posing for the camera, to men stylish, men sharing a beer, wearing, their hats just so, concerned about look, because at this time, I just returned from Zurich, and some of the people in the audience asked, well, so I don't understand what, these images are foreign to me, because the only images we know of black men are lynched men, violence in black communities. So America to us is a violent, has a violent history when it comes to black culture. So they were shocked to see images of these men having a drink, seated, sharing the moment of a beer or a drink, and then with their hats and their shoes. We see their style as they're making a point, and that they pose for the photographer. That a man with his car in Oakland, California, to Eudora Welty's photograph of three women walking down the street in Jackson, Mississippi. These are domestics, this is their day off, this is their moment, where they, as they say, they drag the deuce. They're walking on 2nd Avenue, and so they walk up one side and down the next, across the street. But they are under surveillance. You see young men looking at them as they walk the beat and just enjoy their fashion for the day. That photographer James Latimer Allen photographing Madonna and Child, creating a dialogue with beauty with Christ image, to an image of a woman that's called Harlemesque, has begun to think about how to look at beauty and nudity in Harlem as a central way of identifying beauty, holding the cigarette, a holder, leaning back in the reflection of beauty within that frame. Ouija, another photographer who's known for photographing violence, but here we can see that he's young girls at a concert with their pearls, to women who were dancers on part of the Blackbirds of London. We see them in London and they're standing on the rooftop of the theater, different hairstyles, also different body types, with dancers, again, posing for the photographer. And this is a photograph here of the beach club, the Pacific Beach Club in outside of San Diego, California. This is a community of the four in the front are the winners, the beauty contest winners. We see a large community of blacks in the 1920s in California there to celebrate their own beach club and the beauty contest. As soon as this event happened, the beach club was burned by white racists in the community. And we see here, but this is a document, this photograph is a document of the support of the community, of identifying beauty. Beauty was important because that at this time, most of the images that circulated were stereotyped or negative images of black subjects that were not seen as desirable or educated. Barbershops, this is an outside barbershop by Eisenstadt, and then here's Lewis Hine. And it was really important for me to find images of photographers, both black and white, that were images that basically were erased from their archive. Here we see a young woman in beauty school. We see also that the photographer is photographing in a way of creating beauty and focusing on the mirror image and reflecting the young, taller woman's image in the mirror. That cars, not only the experience of flesh beauty, but also growing up in Philadelphia, cars were a part of that sense of beauty, that the men in the community were so proud of their new cars that they often photographed them. So we don't know who the owner is, but I imagine it's the man leaning on the car, facing the camera. But we see the young boy in the car seated with a dreamlike experience. So how we begin to see how beauty is reflected in that. That a young woman is photographed in a studio in Columbia, South Carolina, with her earrings and her jewelry, and also photographed here with her apron, and which image that she would desire, that she desires as the popular image for her family to preserve. I thought this would possibly be the image that she would want. I was corrected by someone who said, no, this is the image that she would want to preserve because she wants to show her family that she is working in a home, that she's not working in the fields, that we see this as a sense of desire in that way. Also, posing. You know, a woman posing with her fur coat, two young friends walking on Easter Sunday. You also see, in terms of style, this is a graduation day. This is Joe Louis on Howard University's campus. And men in mirrors. Rarely we find images of men, you know, looking in the mirror. And I found it really just a wonderful pause for me to see this is a photograph of Robert McNeil. Range of images of dancers by Tini Harris in the barbershop. And then just appreciating his car and his woman, you know, this kind of experience of this moment posing for Tini Harris. And Tini Harris was also known as Tini, the little lover. And Tini could stop anyone to make that one-shot photograph. And here we see that Tini stops this waitress, but also that he's not interested in there's a little drama growing in this photograph. There's theater. We see a woman in her evening gown walking through. We also see shavings from the pencil sharpener. That we see this is a working place, it's an active place. This is the Crawford Avenue Grill in Pittsburgh. Easter Sunday, a young boy with his new suit, to another Easter Sunday, Russell Lee. And we also see how the young boys are reflecting the experience of their fathers, the men in their community. They're emulating their style, their pose, and we can see the appreciation of the photographer documenting this moment. With these young boys in the car. Easter Sunday, Chicago, outside of church. To Lena Horne, and this is a photograph by Tini Harris. Another image where we see the importance of a leader, a singer, an important moment in the Blue Room, you know, behind the stage with a Western Union telegram on the side. And she was also an important figure in this community, in terms of Black communities, as well as in the larger community, that she was a pinup, that she was a pinup during World War II. And we see that she's posed here with the Tuskegee Airmen on Tuskegee's campus. And as a pinup, she was often experienced with asking for photographs, both Black and white soldiers asked for her photograph. That this photograph I found was so important that when, in Charlie Fuller's soldier story, there was a photograph of Lena Horne also on the bunk of one of the soldiers. So in terms of that kind of detail, looking at real life images, here on Easter Sunday in Harlem, a Black photographer is photographing a young man with his new suit. This is a photograph by Russell Lee. Just understanding that sense of importance in community. Cartier-Bresson, this is the brown skin models. This is one young woman, a 16-year-old model who's walking by, that the photographer is captivated not only by her beauty and fashion, that he also recognizes the young man behind her who is also appreciating her beauty. Ouija's photograph, a man in his top hat, Easter Sunday. Two images that are just a wonderful floral print. Two in this image here, in terms of range of stories, this is Zora Neale Hurston. It's a photograph by Carl Van Vechten. And she writes to Carl Van Vechten to say, when she receives a number of photographs, she says that, I like myself when I'm looking mean and impressive. So here we see a person, this is the first time that I'm actually reading where women and men are accepting the image and having a response to some of the photographs. Camera girls, women worked in clubs and made photographs of people who attended. And Walker Evans photographed 42nd Street, woman in her fur coat. And style, 40s. We can see a man with his cigarette holder and then also reflecting his own beauty within the photographs on the side. This is also Cartier-Bresson, brown skin models. And another image this just stopped me in my research. This is two women and it's titled Two Young Girls, Dixie Bells, Teenagers in Louisiana. And this is a period when Black women and men children could not look in the eyes of white men or women in the communities in the South. And so here we see two very stylish young girls, their hats just so in terms of the way they have it tilted, cocked, and then wearing their jewelry, but looking directly and defiantly in the photographer's eye. The photographer also understood their beauty and recognized their beauty. His name is Fontel Wynans. This is in terms of dualities. I just noticed things as I researched here, like two women in Harlem, two women in Louisiana, two women in Washington Square Park in the 60s. Begin to see how beauty, in terms of reflecting beauty in this sense, that this image of John Mosley's photograph here that's in Philadelphia with Billy Eckstein and Billie Holiday, who we're known for the image, Billie Holiday is known for an image of the flower in her hair. The photographer is able to capture it and the appreciation of the two, understanding their beauty and style. And this photograph here by Eve Arnold, just a wonderful moment, not posed, but she's able to see the beauty of a strong figure, but also his sense of fashion and style with the way that he kind of tilts his hat as he is in thought, that he's wearing a fashionable watch, and then also wearing his religion on his finger, you know, just keeping that ever present. And also Bob Edelman's photograph here of Rosa Parks. And we see Rosa Parks in 1963 at the March on Washington. And that she is wearing her pearls, her lace gloves. We begin to think about reading the experience of women who attended the march. The women were silenced at the march. The women were prepared to speak, but many were asked not to speak. But we see that here, this is a woman who possibly, if she was asked to speak, she was ready. And you can see by the way that she's dressed. We also see debutante balls, that here is posing Eve Arnold. And as we begin to see Muhammad Ali, who understood beauty, he often said, "Ain't I beautiful, aren't I pretty?" You know, and then he is posing in that sense. One of my other favorites is this is by Bruce Davidson, you know, Venice Beach. We see, you know, a black man in his underwear posing, you know, with his muscles. We see an older, middle-aged woman, you know, with a brownie photographing him. And I just find her husband in the backdrop, you know, hands in pocket, you know, just kind of creating this dialogue is just so beautiful. But we begin to see how important it is to recognize the beauty within ways of at muscle beach contests in Venice Beach to Carnegie Hall, to image of Angela Davis, a significant figure who often talked about the importance of hair and everyone talked about wearing the Angela Davis afro. And she felt that she was reflecting what the community's experience with her hair. Just a wonderful, as I hear you just kind of move that moment. This is what happened to me when I saw this image of James Baldwin. That James Baldwin also understood his beauty in his words. We never heard people talk about his beauty in any public way, but this photographer was often able to capture this in this quiet moment as he smokes and then he's in a reflective pose. Huey Newton, you know, here we see, you know, this body type that people followed, young people followed and believed in the dream of the Black Panther Party, but also, you know, his music. We also see intellect. We see books by, you know, within the frame. This is a photograph by Stephen Sheamus, and where we see the importance of how Huey Newton felt about his own body, but also as a leader. Also, Mary McCabe, when I was growing up, you know, Ed Sullivan, I saw her on the Ed Sullivan Show. She was significant to me as a woman who wore hair in a natural hairstyle, close cropped, understood her sensuality, and her beauty. And just a way of, you know, some of the pictures for me in the book are highly personal because it helped transform my understanding of beauty. this is Jamal Shabazz, just three young girls, you know, Catherine, you know, just in the backdrop, and then they pose for the photographer. In a beauty shop, Eli Reed, just beautiful light, and to Mary Lou Williams, just seated in her apartment with her parakeet. Significant also, some of my students said, well, where are the older people in your photographs, you know, and the experience of beauty? And I said, I have a few, you know, don't worry about that. And I found this Wendell White image of a woman in New Jersey, just understanding her space, her doilies, her art on the wall, and just the way she has her arm placed on the back of the sofa, that she understands her sense of presence and the beauty in her home. The Carrie Mae Weems, it's the portrait that she created, says, I looked and looked and wondered what terrified you. So here she is reflecting and thinking about the experience of the historical over 300, 200 years of images that reflected negative images of black men and women, and as she looks in the mirror and asks the question. Jeffrey Scales, a man in plaid pants, to Denzel Washington, Jeffrey Scales. This is work by Bobby Sinstack, and it's called Brothers in the Hood, and this is in Chicago. Jamal Shabazz, this is called Back in the Days, a time before crack, where crack destroyed communities. We see a young man just posing with his Adidas. He says, just take a picture of my new Adidas, you know, and he just makes this fantastic pose. And that's what he wanted to focus on. Just a couple on the Lower East Side. And then also women who are documenting the experience of lesbian beauty. This is Lola Flash. This is a woman on London Bridge wearing a New York City t-shirt. And another woman who is standing on a rooftop in New York City. This is a work by Micheline Thomas. And Micheline Thomas is looking, it's called Sister, Sister Blue, looking at the 70s as a reflective experience, thinking about how growing up during that time period where women understood their beauty through hair, through fashion, and music. Bayate Ross-Smith, this is prom night. This is first time becoming adults. This is what he titles. Heidi Heidi Ho, prom night. And Aretha Franklin, wonderful image by Friedlander. To Eve Arnold's photograph, here this is an intervention where a black woman and a white woman are looking in the mirror and they're preparing to meet to talk about race. And we see both of them looking in the mirror, understanding and appreciating their beauty. Bobby Sinstack's photograph of James Brown and Muhammad Ali, just also as they look at each other and see their beauty outside the people around the side of the Bud Billiken Day Parade, just not even important to this moment. Also musicians and the experience of Jimi Hendrix with style and the fact that he has this kind of bubble image of his likeness in on stage. To Isaac Hayes, and this is Ernest Withers' photograph, you know, fashion and style point in this period of the 70s where fashion became a storytelling moment where the people, men and women in the community, understood it and flaunted and it also created a way of telling their experience of style through their notion of black style and community. This is a photograph, Sophie Carmichael, by Leroy Henderson. And as leaders spoke and lectured, they also were also concerned about their image. This is Ken Ramsey's photograph of the cover image. This is Susan Taylor. Susan Taylor, who's known for Essence magazine. Here she is posed in 1974, wearing the large hoop earrings, the same type of hoop earrings that we see with the image in 1900. So we see this kind of repeating image. John Lee Hooker, you know, just kind of just one moment, understanding what the camera transforms this look. naming Marvelous Marvin, you know, just kind of that moment here. Anthony Barboza's photograph with light imitating art. And here we see two couples walking down the street, and we can see the movies of that time period creating this style. Ife Aslam, and Ife is also experiencing looking at movies like Coffee, that women during that time period had to wear certain styles to create a moment of beauty, but also to clean up their communities. And so she's making self-portraits. To a young woman wearing an Afro wig on St. Patrick's Day. And then I'm going to end with this last image here. And this is an image, and this is by Petruska Basin. And Petruska is looking at how women are dressing at nightclubs and creating where this whole sense of surveillance, where men are following women around. And you can see here, there is a camcorder reflection here, that her beauty is captivated, that it needs to be documented and recorded. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to just kind of open up the questions, but just to experience this research, focus on, and hopefully you'll able to purchase the book, but it's a way of telling a story that reflects beauty in a broader sense from the 1890s to now. And if you have a question, it'd be great for you to speak into the mic. Thank you.
Good evening. I have a question, and I'm not
sure. Did you say your name was short?
My name is Valerie Adams, and I'm a doctoral student. My dissertation is actually looking at media images and black identity. So I'm hoping, I've been doing a couple focus groups with young people, both male and female adolescents, and I was hoping you might be able to speak a little bit to these images and how you contextualize these images for young people who are seeing images of blackness, if you will, globally, and what that means in terms of their style of dress, maybe their own body image and identity as black people.
It's a long question. Right, well, this is an image here, is Sheila Free Bright. As I talk to young people often about images, that they're affected by Barbie images and believing the believability of Barbie. And this is Sheila Free Bright, who's actually merging real life images to images of desire and distorted images. And we can begin to see how Barbie has distorted the sense of beauty within different communities. And so I'm often going through that experience with young people to talk about how to tell a story outside of media images, that we all know that advertising has a big effect and large effect on most of us. And so we just kind of constantly talk to young people about that experience. So I look forward to reading your work so that we can begin to incorporate some of the things that you're doing in that sense of talking to young people. And one, as I travel, as I mentioned, around in different countries, that most of the media images that people see of black people are distorted. And so it's not just young people, it's worldwide. And that's something that this book, I'm hoping, will begin to open up another way of reading images. And there's a question.
Hi, I'm Sophie Sanders, and also a doctoral student. I guess I'm drooling over all the images. They're so amazing and inspiring. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the Black is Beautiful movement and how that transformation has had, even now, even to this day, such a long impact. And also, I'm curious how you would differentiate between artists celebrating their own beauty, black artists looking at the body, versus artists of other races or ethnicities, you know, whatever ethnicity the artist is, in terms of this idea of exoticism and the body, because I feel like when artists are documenting their own beauty, or sisters and brothers, it's a different impulse than someone of another culture saying, oh, that's, you're such a beautiful person, I want to take a photograph of you. So how do you deal with those different impulses and this idea of exoticization of oneself, or feeling proud of one's beauty?
I think it's mainly the intent of the image. You know, I'm not looking at, I think that there are, we can also exoticize ourselves. So that's something that it's not just, you know, them, others, and it's reflective in that experience. So I'm interested in looking at my work basically reflects on the interests of younger artists who are looking at, like Baye K. Ross Smith, they're looking at those three young girls, they're exoticizing themselves based on the images of hip-hop culture. And they see that. So that's the sense of exoticism. We can look at Carrie Mae Weems, who's also looking and reflecting on the experience of beauty by wandering through the historical images of that sense of how women and blacks have been photographed over the years. So my work is looking at the range of images from black photographers, white photographers, and artists who are just interested in exploring the experience of beauty. But this is an archive that is a created archive through my vision. And it's mainly because I believe a lot of these images were lost in terms of the larger history of photography. And when some of the photographers who are known in this book, rarely will we find the white photographers, will we find images of their black subjects in their books. And so what I wanted to do with this book is just kind of open up a new discussion about it. And I have the Black Experience, the Black is Beautiful movement, in terms of, it was a political movement, and understanding how refuting the past through the stereotyped images. And it was really a way that recreating it today, and if we can do the same with young people to remind them of their beauty. There was a 16-year-old who attended my talk and said that she had never experienced any of the images or never questioned, and she was so moved that she says, I want people to know about this book, people of my generation, and we need to spread the word because we need to see a range of images. And so what I'm doing, and I'm hoping that it comes across, is just to begin to expand on ideas about it. And with two doctoral students in this discussion, I'm hoping that your books will really help transform all of this. Thank you. Thank you. Are the books sold upstairs?
I know that listening to a slideshow presentation is probably not the best idea of radio, but I hope and encourage you to check out the book. Again, it's called Posing Beauty, African American Images from 1890 to the Present. I also hope that today's show provided some insight to the difficulty and complexity that comes along with African American imagery, especially in the media. While we applaud the positive progression of inclusion in mainstream media, we are also conscious that sometimes these images present a thin line between that progression and exploitation, especially when the reader or viewer has no other frame of reference. That we can blame on the educational system. However, that's a topic for another show. I hope that you have enjoyed today's People, Places, and Things. If you would like to listen to the show or other great episodes, please visit me at peopleplacesthingsradio.com. As always, your feedback is welcome at ppt@gtownradio.com. I leave you today with a final thought from Mama Linda Goss, award-winning storyteller and founder of the National Association of Black Storytellers, who performed some of her work at last year's Black Writing Festival. I am your host, Shireen Ball, asking that you join me again next week for another edition of People, Places, and Things. So until next time, peace, and peace be unto Haiti.